And we'll go ahead and call our first case today, which is case number 59382, Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department versus Yegazarian. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Now we have Mr. Anderson for the appellants, Mr. Seguis for the respondents. So, Mr. Anderson, we proceed. And do you wish to reserve any time?
Yes, I'll reserve 3 minutes.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. Craig Anderson on behalf of the defendants' appellants. And today we're here on this appeal that involves the district court's erroneous exclusion of alcohol consumption at a civil trial involving a fatal motor vehicle accident. The issue of alcohol was brought up during a counter motion in limine filed by the plaintiffs prior to trial. After argument, the Honorable Judge Reese ruled that the alcohol was not admissible because the defendants did not have an expert who would testify regarding the effect of alcohol upon the decedent, and then also that if it was relevant, he found that it would probably be unfairly prejudicial to allow the jury to hear that evidence.
What about the conduct? It was a .049, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, so
the legal limit's .08, isn't it?
Correct. It was below the legal limit. That's not disputed. There was never going to be any argument by the defendants that he was above the legal limit and intoxicated. The purpose of the .049 alcohol level was to explain to the jury as a comparative negligence issue that there were other factors involved in this accident. And there's a wealth of case law that was cited from both federal and state law courts that have held that when you're arguing causation and comparative negligence, the issue of alcohol consumption is certainly relevant and admissible in a trial. Now, it's not dispositive, but the way it would come in would be, in this case, there was the issue as to why Mr. Yegazarian did not perceive Officer Ricks' vehicle. There were two eyewitnesses behind Mr. Yegazarian who testified at trial and in depositions.
Counsel, the question, I guess, for this is you have a naked fact, the blood test result. And the question I have for you reading this is, what else did you have in terms of, did it impair, did it not impair? Did you have some kind of witness who observed the gentleman prior that you were going to bring into court? Otherwise, the question is whether it is more prejudicial than probative, and was the court correct in looking at it that way?
Okay, well, to answer the last part of your question, no, the court was not correct, and now I'll answer your question in turn. It's corroborating evidence, okay, which is not a requirement, but there was. Officer Duffy.
Counsel.
Yes.
When you get to relevance, the point on the scale, since it's not itself showing that he is alcoholically impaired by law, then there needs to be some showing that there's relevance and why it's not prejudicial.
Okay. You want me to answer your question that you started with? Okay.
I would like the question answered.
Okay, so the first, what was the other evidence? The other evidence was that Officer Duffy smelled alcohol, which is the reason that it became an issue. There was an officer on scene who recognized the odor of alcohol and realized that it may be a factor, and therefore he ordered it. In addition to that, there were two eyewitnesses behind Mr. Yegazarian who were in the car behind him who perceived the officer's vehicle, and they both testified that they could tell it was not safe to go, and that they did not understand why he was turning. So that is evidence that they were wondering, what's this guy doing? Now, with respect to the fact that the alcohol is below the legal limit and what's its relevance, it is, as a layperson, all individuals know that alcohol may have some impact and impairment on a person's motor skills, ability to perceive.
But isn't it based upon, quite often, when you look at that, the height, weight, food content, a number of things that come into play as to an individual, their ability to handle alcohol or not handle alcohol?
And those questions could have been asked of the family if it was allowed at the time of trial. Was he a heavy drinker? Did he drink regularly? Did you ever see him when he drank? How did it affect him? But because the court effectively cut us off at the knees with the alcohol issue, we were not allowed to even explore those type of issues. And the issue here is not that it's dispositive that the alcohol impaired him, but it's a factor. It's similar that if someone is talking on their cell phone, holding a hamburger, holding a drink, that's not illegal. It's not wrong to do that. But you're allowed to bring that up to say, hey, maybe this person was not as cautious as they could have been. And the jury at that point would have had the evidence of the alcohol content, juries are very smart. They could, a juror may have walked into that room and said, he's not above the legal limit, I'm not even considering it. Or the jury may have said, you know what, that explains to me why he perceived that. But to say that a jury is not capable of handling that evidence is insulting to the jurors, because they are all aware through their common experience and knowledge of the role that alcohol would play on a person, and they are free to disregard that, and they are free to include it. But it's a factor that was critical to our case, because it gave us an explanation as to why he's comparatively at fault and to the issues of causation. Did I answer your questions appropriately, Your Honor?
I'm not sure if it was appropriately answered, but if that's your answer, I'll accept that at this time.
Well, and I would respond, there's numerous cases that we've cited from both federal and other state courts. None of them are binding upon this court. I read
most of them are very distinguishable in terms of this particular case, counsel, because I did review those cases to see the common knowledge you put forth for the court to consider, and whether or not it should alter what the district court did. But we said to this for oral argument today because we're interested in hearing why we should look at this other than how the district court looked at it.
Okay, and then the other issue that I would bring up is the FGA Giglio case, which was decided between our opening brief and our reply brief. So it wasn't the law when we did this. And in the Giglio case, this court did not issue any rulings that expert testimony were required or that it was unfairly prejudicial. As Your Honor is very well aware, that case involved two people's alcohol consumption, a plaintiff who supposedly slipped on a substance, and her boyfriend who witnessed the fall. And because comparative negligence and causation were not brought up by the plaintiff, the court found that it was unfairly prejudicial. But with respect to the witness, this court found, without a requirement of expert testimony or unfair prejudice, that it was relevant as to whether he was able to perceive what he claimed to have perceived, which is exactly what we're saying in this case. Was he able to perceive?
Counsel, can I go back? Because you stated the fact that I was going back and reading more material, because it just kind of climbed off the side of my ear. You indicated someone had smelled alcohol. The problem I have, and I remember this, was we had testimony given at the time that alcohol was smelled, but the statement was by an officer that someone else told him. So that wasn't the part of it. It was a hearsay situation, which kind of troubled me at the time. Not to mention the secondary thing, which was blood tests were ordered, but it doesn't say without anyone's permission. So those two things bothered me in reading what the district court looked at.
Okay, and I believe that the statement about the alcohol consumption was Officer Redfern, Detective Redfern, quoting Officer Duffy. Officer Duffy was the individual who smelled it. He relayed that information to Detective Redfern, who included it in his report. And Officer Duffy was going to testify at trial. He was a named witness and prepared to testify. He was the person that smelled it. He reported that to his supervisor, Detective Redfern, who was doing the fatal report, who included that in the report. Okay, and then with respect to your second question about the blood draw, and I apologize, I do not know the name of the case. I do know there was a Supreme Court case that came out on the Fourth Amendment issue about forced blood draws after this incident, stating that a forced blood draw is unconstitutional. However, there were exceptions to that, and one of those was exigent circumstances if the person's life was in danger.
Counsel, I know you have a couple other issues here. I know I'm interested in the comparative negligence application when you do the reduction and the attorney's fees issue, so
okay.
Maybe you could touch on those too.
That is certainly an interesting issue that's not been addressed yet by this court. So it is a matter of first impression. And what it is the interplay between NRS 41.035, which is a statutory cap damage at the time of the incident, $50,000, and then the comparative fault statute, which is NRS 41.41. The statutory $50,000 cap applies to an award of damages. And in NRS 41.035, you can't have an award of damages greater than $50,000. And so the comparative fault is taken off, according to the statute, the award of damages. Okay? So that would be the starting point, would be $50,000, and the comparative would be taken off of that. In their responding brief, they cited to the Eaton case, which did not involve NRS 41.141 or comparative fault. What that case involved was offsets, which made the somewhat problematic issue that if you get a high enough offset, you could pay nothing. That would not be the case here in the interplay between NRS 41.141 or 41.035, because you're simply subtracting the comparative fault from that number. And I don't really have the other guidance on that, so.
Well, it looks like a first impression issue. Yeah. We'll hear from the opposing counsel on that, and we'll tackle that issue as well. Attorney's fees?
Mm-hmm. With the attorney's fees, the issue there was that they included in their request for attorney's fees the work of paralegals and staff. And it's our opinion that those are not compensable under the statute, 68 or NRS 17.115, because they specifically limit to attorney's fees. And it's also one of the problematic nature of most of the time billed by the paralegal is in conjunction with one or two attorneys. So you're getting the incentive to just bring multiple people into a room to participate in
total. Well, how much did they request in total and how much was awarded by the district court?
Okay, well, they requested the full sum from the start of the case to the end, which was over $200,000. The district court gave them $80,000 plus from the time of the offer of judgment. Okay, so they filed the offer of judgment. Well, about $54,000 of that was for attorney's fees, and then $33,000 of that was for the paralegal and the staff time. And so what we're asking for is a reduction of the paralegal and staff time to just be duplicative, that it's outside of the statute, the 68 and NRS 17.115, because they strictly limit the recovery to attorney's fees. Mm-hmm. And so we're asking for, I think it's roughly a $34,000 reduction, which just simply represents staff, paralegal, and health time, but not the time of the attorneys. Okay, we'll do that's duplicative.
In this particular area, isn't the law starting to change? I know the statute is very specific, and you're correct in terms of, you know, resuscitation of the statute, but haven't courts across the country and even the federal district court begun to apply a slightly different standard understanding of the practice so that we're not dealing at the highest rate of legal services provided anymore?
Well, I believe the trend started with Missouri versus Jenkins, which was a Supreme Court case, which is not binding upon this court, but it did find that with Judge Rehnquist, you know, issuing a pretty persuasive dissenting opinion. And that leads us into another problem with this case, is that the paralegal's time was not considered under the Brunzell factors. And so it was, they analyzed the attorney's fees, and then they just said, oh, we're throwing the $34,000 on too, which we believe a lot of that was duplicative and unnecessary time. So that should at least go back to the district court if you're going to follow the Supreme Court's decision in Missouri.
Is the practice in the district court presently to review each attorney that touched the file and is included in attorney's fees request under the Brunzell or only, say, the lead attorney?
Well, I can't answer that question because I've not dealt with this issue. You know, in federal court is where I primarily deal with it, so I can't give you a satisfactory answer. But I would say that if you did read the bills in this case, you would see there's a lot of duplicative time that is problematic with that they do need to be addressed. Is this a task that requires three people type of an analysis?
Okay. You want to reserve the balance?
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Segues.
Good morning, Justices. It's an honor to be before you. I would say in response to the alcohol consumption, Justice Douglas is on point with this court's previous opinion. I believe perhaps he authored the previous opinion in Giglio, which is evidence of alcohol consumption alone is too prejudicial to put before the jury because the jury is going to have to guess or speculate as to that alcohol consumption's effect on one's, as it contributed to the incident. Alcohol consumption corroborated with intoxication is sometimes considered admissible.
I didn't mean to interrupt. You suggest that had the alcohol consumption been placed before the jury that there would have or should have been corroborating evidence. I thought I heard the appellant in this case suggest that there was or were several witnesses who could testify to, obviously not the consumption itself, perhaps, but the fact that there were other things that, like, that perhaps this jury should have known. Meaning, if he had been drinking out of a, you know, big gulp, would we have allowed that to come in to show his perception at the time of this accident? Would we have allowed that testimony to come in, or is it just the fact that it's alcohol-related that is of concern to you in terms of the prejudice?
I think the concern with current status in state law is that evidence of mere consumption without any evidence of impairment, the effect of that consumption on the individual's ability to speak clearly, function properly, walk without staggering, speak without a thick tongue, all of these different things that other courts have said, there's got to be some evidence of that alcohol's effect on the individual's abilities. Because without it, the jury, as you said, to use your example, will hear, yeah, he had a big gulp, a huge big gulp, but perhaps he didn't take one sip of beer. Perhaps he watched the entire football game without having a sip. But there's evidence that he had a 64-ounce beer in his hand. Well, that's prejudicial because it's going to force the jury to engage in conjecture, and that is to come to a conclusion without any real evidence, any real factual proof. What happened in this case was the only singular piece of evidence of alcohol consumption truly was the BAC level of 0.49. The defendants did not have an expert to talk about and or interpret what that or how that could affect a 6'2", 47-year-old man who weighs 240 pounds. Like you said earlier, heavy drinker, not a heavy drinker, etc. It was devoid of evidence. What the defense sought to do, and the judge correctly excluded it, was just put that number before the jury and say, ultimately, take a guess on how much that impaired his ability, and then come to a percentage fault based on that guess. Because there were no additional witnesses, not a singular witness could testify that he staggered when he walked, he was mumbling, he had glassy eyes, nothing. The only thing that the court has heard so far in relation to impairment is part and parcel of the incident. Nothing preceding the incident, but the incident itself, trying to wrap in the things that could show impairment into what all other courts, including this one, says would have to predate the incident, not the incident itself. So in Giglio, it's right on point. The court's distinction was the woman who fell at the restaurant, Carmine's Little Italy, she fell. Evidence of her alcohol consumption is inadmissible because there was insufficient evidence of impairment or intoxication. However, a witness to the fall, the witness, you could introduce that evidence because it goes to their ability to recall or perceive. Now that's a completely different standard. And in their brief, they referenced the fact that this court allowed the witness, non-party, to testify or evidence to be introduced in relation to alcohol consumption. But all courts, almost all courts, state courts, agree that when it goes to show contribution to fault, when it goes to negligence, not ability to perceive or recall, but when it goes to fault, there must be some corroborating evidence of impairment, or else the jury is left to literally guess. The next issue, if I could shift gears with the court's permission, comparative fault. We cited State versus Eaton because that seems to be the best interpretation of that NRS of 41035 in conjunction with 41141. And that is to say, and to quote the court, under the state's proposal, in this case the defendant's proposal, this judgment that we received of $2 million would be reduced to $50,000 before $75,000 received for release was subtracted. And here's the logic. Thus, the state will sustain no liability despite a $1 million judgment against it. This result contravenes the legislative purpose of the statutory waiver of immunity for actions against the state. It's almost identical to what happened here. We got a $2 million judgment. The court asked them, in improper order, to assign percentage fault in conjunction with their original $2 million award. The jury assigned fault, and the judge said as a result of the jury's determinations, the plaintiffs are awarded $1.5 million. That all happened in one chunk at trial. Then the judge said, unfortunately, this must be reduced to $50,000 per plaintiff. The wife got $800,000, the estate got $600,000, and each child, three teenagers, got $200,000.
So the jury never knew about the cap?
They never knew. Never heard a word.
Okay.
And they awarded $2 million. The court appropriately and in order, right at that same hearing, assigned percentage by 25%, reduced it to $1.5 million, and then concluded by saying, the plaintiffs are not in a position to take $1.5 million. There is a statutory cap on the actual award, and this actual award is $1.5 million, so I will reduce it to $50,000 per plaintiff, the three children and the mom. And that's what happened. And that is completely consistent with the legislative purpose and consistent with the statutory label, because this award did not exceed $50,000 per plaintiff, consistent with the statute. And then moving along to attorney's fees, with the court's permission.
Please, go ahead.
The current law of the land, Jenkins, and the current trend, as stated by Justice Douglas, is pretty straightforward, and it does effectuate lower bills. And that is to bill paralegals and legal professionals at their hourly rate of $65 versus $400 per hour for the attorney. You know, it's kind of there's a bit of irony because what they're actually asking is that the attorneys would change the $65 hour to a $400 hour, making our bill not $80-something thousand, but well into $140,000.
And obviously, that's the obvious practical effect. I think everybody would probably agree on that. The problem is, I think your opposing counsel said there's no Nevada authority under 17.115 or I assume Rule 68 and 1800 to do that. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, in regard to the attorney's fees, you know, it is within the trial court's discretion under Shawiler versus Unison to allow attorney's fees and to make the decision based on what are reasonable attorney's fees and what's going to be included. Now, Yancey, this is a Nevada Supreme Court case, I'm sure you're familiar, called for the premise that the proposition that if, in fact, the district court makes a determination of attorney's fees, this court won't overturn that decision, falling short of arbitrary or capricious conduct on behalf of the district court judge. And we simply don't have that. The judge analyzed our bill under Brunzell and Beatty. He made a determination that the original request of $217,000 was going to be reduced to $80-something thousand. And he redlined line by line by line by line. I mean, very, very thorough. He reduced out of our expert fees substantially. I remember one particular expert was reduced from $21,000 down to $10,000. And ultimately, he was very diligent in assigning this dollar amount of $80,000+. So absent arbitrary or capricious conduct or action in that decision on behalf of the trial court judge, generally this honorable court won't disturb that decision.
And we certainly know that's the standard review. I suspect the present counsel is going to get up and say that it is arbitrary and capricious to award attorney's fees to a lawyer, because I know that. Cindy is going to say that since he speaks last. What's your response to that?
Simply put, again, in having a fair parsing of the work performed, a letter drafted to Mr. Anderson, reviewed and signed by me, I would prefer, and I think the court would agree, that a $65 rate for that letter, versus someone has to account for that time put into this case. It doesn't just go off into the air because a barred individual didn't do it. Someone has to account for it. So it's more fair to have a $65 hour for a letter versus a $400 an hour for the production of the letter, and I think it benefits the defense to have it that way.
Okay. So even though there's no statutory authority to, or rule authority to award attorney's fees for paralegal services, you think we should create that exception for a practical basis because it's actually less money?
Absolutely. I think as a practical basis, it makes good sense. It's fair to both sides. And under Jenkins, it's actually the United States Supreme Court's decision that attorney's fees was never meant to include only those who are licensed to practice before the court in that state. It's all fees associated with processing the case.
Okay. Well, I'm going to agree.
Go ahead, Justice.
I heard a bell earlier.
No, that was just the other time. So okay.
Well, I might agree that the trend toward efficiency in our profession is a good thing. What would your answer be with respect to those items on the bill that they claim are duplicative? That certainly flies in the face of the argument that we're being efficient.
Right, and I read that argument, and I can find no evidence. If the court has the joint appendix, they can go through that. Nothing is duplicative. I mean, they said it, but it is not duplicative. And the trial court judge literally, line by line, analyzed every bill, billable hour or quarter hour. I think we did it in a 0.10. And the judge found no duplicative billing.
But if there was duplicative billing, it would be something that would be obviously offset at the lower rate.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly, and that were excluded entirely because a letter shouldn't be at $400 plus $65 for the same hour. Absolutely not. And it never was.
Okay. I share Justice Sotomayor's concern. That was part of my question. But going further, even if I accept Jenkins as having some controlling interest, the question is whether or not, if the court looks to see what the reasonable value of attorney services is, should the court look to see what the reasonable value of paralegal service?
I think that would be a good... under the assumption that the attorneys are making good decisions in hiring quality paralegals, which may not always be the case, you know, the attorney who kind of steers the ship and may have two or three attorneys below him, and he's supervising those two or three attorneys along with maybe a paralegal or two, it's my understanding that the lead attorney, especially in larger firms, that the lead attorney, it's his bargain number and his responsibility to be quality and oversee the quality of the work done below him.
The question is the reasonable value of services in our community.
Yes, in other words, it's $65 an hour for a paralegal reasonable.
I guess you would need to do a Brunzell type analysis on the paralegal fees, assuming, is that the issue, Justice? Assuming they were going to allow them, does it have to go through the same formal scrutiny? I know it's been gone through scrutiny, as you pointed out, but do we have to have that, something equivalent to Brunzell?
That's an excellent question, and I think Brunzell and Beatty are satisfied when the lead counsel who primarily handled the case and had attorneys below him and paralegals below him, when he is scrutinized under those standards, the assumption being that he's screening the work that's coming up to him from, let's say, a paralegal, and he's approving it, changing it, editing it, and making it the quality of the individual lawyer handling the case.
So I accept that argument in a pure vacuum, then we could bill paralegals at the same rate as we bill the attorneys.
But we don't. And that's why this is the right practice.
Don't we? And that goes back to the reason we listen to bill.
Because we don't, because I'm an honest individual.
That's not before us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson, you have about a little over 2 minutes.
Just before Your Honors, I would like to return to the alcohol issue. When we talk about these corroborating factors, the distinguishing factor of the cases that we're relying upon is those cases didn't have the benefit of a BAC. Yes, the corroborating factors were showing that alcohol had indeed been consumed. You know, we can assume this person consumed alcohol because he was staggering, he had slurred speech. Here, we know alcohol was consumed. So that is the corroborating factor. That is the difference in this case, is that we know he did. The other cases are saying, look, well, can we trust that this person was intoxicated? Well,
what was your proffer to the court before the court indicated the experts couldn't opine? What was the proffer? What set this up that you offered the court that we can do this?
The proffer would have been, one, that Officer Duffy smelled alcohol, which I believe is admissible.
What would have been? What was it?
Okay, maybe I'm not following your question, but evidence...
You need to know in the exchange in the court before the court said he was not going to allow this, what proffer did he make to the court? We would have put in this.
I really didn't get that far with the court because I brought up the relevance issue and the court moved directly into you need an expert. And the court stuck with the expert theme throughout the hearing in the record, saying you don't have an expert, no evidence.
And you made no proffer as to what you would have introduced. If you had an opportunity.
We had in our briefs, we would have used Officer Duffy and then also the medical records were limited into evidence that the BAC would have been in there. And so that would have been our proffer. We would have brought it in through those two pieces of evidence. And also, I think it's important and worth noting that we had jury questions specifically on this issue. Did they consume alcohol at the July 4th party? And showing that they wanted this information before them. And then they could have done with it what they wanted. But the jury was smart enough to catch on, to ask.
I'm not questioning whether the jury was smart enough or not smart enough. The jury is supposed to calculate based upon what's presented to it. So the question I have goes back to, what were you going to offer? Did you have any witnesses that observed the plaintiff prior to the accident, sometime before he left wherever he was? Well, we did say he was impaired opposed to just, I smelled, and this is a blood alcohol, and that's the extent of it.
Well, that's an interesting point, because we did have family members who were deposed, who testified, who were at the party with him, who said he didn't. They didn't see
that. I asked what was proffered to the court.
Which then would go into the issue of their credibility. And it could have played a larger role in with them saying, we didn't see him consume any, well, we know that he did. And so the fact that the family was willing to say they didn't see any actually would have worked potentially in our favor of getting all of this in, that we have people denying he did, that he didn't consume any, but when we know that he did. And so it could have been... through their denial, it could have come in when he did, then they could have seen that maybe there was a credibility issue.
If I may just 1 minute follow up on Justice Douglas. So did I hear you correctly responding to Justice Douglas, is that when you brought this to the judge for his consideration, you were prepared to make a proffer, but were unable to do so simply because of the shift in the focus of the judge. Is that right?
If you read the transcript, I got shut down pretty quick. and then that was kind of... Then he said, I don't even know if this is relevant. If I did find it was relevant, then I would find it was unfairly prejudicial. And so we just kind of threw that out there, too. But it was mainly on the expert issue, Your Honors.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, then. Thank you all for your excellent briefs and arguments. Good to see all of you here. And I'm glad you could do it in Las Vegas as opposed to flying up to Carson City, even though the weather's quite cooler in Carson City. But glad to have you here, and we'll take this matter under submission.